Welcome to the Not Sorry Art Podcast. I'm Sari Shrike, the artist and creator behind Not Sorry Art. I'm so excited to talk art and creativity with you, so grab a drink, grab a snack, and let's dive in. Are you looking to gain confidence in your painting practice and improve your sense of color, composition, drawing? At Not Sorry Art School, I teach representational painting techniques that'll help you feel more in control of your art and elevate your abilities. With 16 courses from color theories to master studies, painting water, portrait painting, and our latest edition, painting fabric, you'll have everything you need to master representational painting. With access to current and future courses, a supportive community, and personalized feedback, you'll be well on your way to achieving your artistic goals. Lifetime students get full access to all of this, but if you're not ready to commit yet, try our free 7-day boot camp. This is a great way to experience a bite-sized version of what our full course has to offer. To become a lifetime student or check out the 7-day boot camp, make sure to click the link in the show notes. Hey, all, welcome to the Not Sorry Art Podcast. I'm Sari. Thanks for being here. Today's episode is about one of my favorite books. It is How to Do Nothing by Jenny Odell. It's fantastic. This episode is going to be a brief summary, but mostly I've mined out all of the best things that this book has to offer. For context, every month this year, I am doing a book recommendation for my online art school students. It fits into a larger syllabus that I have for them. This year is the year of rest and creativity. Yes, that is a nod to the year of rest and relaxation. But the idea is that every month and every season has sort of a theme. Winter is all about rest and reflection and goal setting. And January in particular is about how to rest. And this book was recommended to me a couple years ago by we know her, we love her, friend of the podcast, Megan E. Collins. And it was written, the book was written in response to the 2016 election cycle. And as we know, part of that election cycle, and honestly, the news cycles ever since, has been very much a distract and constant barrage of ever increasingly dystopian news out of the news cycles. And this book was written in response to how to deal with that without completely disengaging. The title, I know, the title doesn't do it really justice because it sort of sounds like it might be a just put cucumber slices over your eyes and do nothing. And I feel like we're at this point with attention that it is like similarly categorized as like, you know how we all know that like eating more whole plant foods and, you know, whole foods, less processed foods, I guess, and exercising is like good for you. But like if someone was just like, oh, I know the solution to all your health problems is just go on more walks and eat more leafy greens, we would all kind of like roll our eyes because like, yes, of course, we already know that. And I feel like attention and engaging with the news cycle, we all know to some degree that that's not good, right? I mean, ignorance is bliss, right? That's a very age-old cliche, and for a reason. The more informed you are, the more, you know, that information can really weigh on your conscience and is distressing to hear. But we stay plugged in. Well, the author goes into for a multitude of reasons in the book, but we stay plugged in, I think a lot of us, especially artists, because we don't want to be disengaged. We want to do our civic duty of staying plugged in and helping and responding. And a lot of us, our art, whether it's very direct or indirect, are responding to the culture at large. And a lot of our ways of staying tethered in is through social media, which is often driven by news cycles and sensational stories. And so how does one navigate that without completely pulling away? Like, yes, of course, living next to the ocean and, you know, picking produce out of our backyards while staying blissfully unaware of anything happening in the world would be probably the best thing for our heart health. But for anyone who doesn't see that as like a viable option for themselves, how does one mindfully engage with that and also keep their sanity? This book seeks to answer that. And while you do feel at the other end of reading this book twice now that there is no silver bullet, it's still something you have to meaningfully navigate, and it is going to be very personal to whoever is engaging. I do think this book allows you to walk away with a new framework, some wisdom, and honestly some really practical tactics of how to intentionally take back your attention span from the news cycle and how we can best use that attention as artists to create the meaningful change if that's something we seek to do. All that to say, let's jump into this book. I'm going to briefly go over some of the key points of the book and then my takeaway and how I can, I think, more specifically tailor that to visual artists, despite the fact the book was written by an artist and it does have very good, I think, application for artists. It was written with the general populace in mind, so I will tailor a little bit more specifically in my own interpretation. So if that sounds good, let's jump into the episode. So I want to first start by talking about the attention economy. But before I lay on some, you know, Wikipedia search answer for you, I want to talk to you about something that happened with my kids recently. So I have recently started letting my 9-year-old play video games with me at night on my phone, right? I'm really maybe overly kind of freaked out by screen time with my kids. Just, I mean, I guess gestures at book, right? Like it's just, I'm always really intentional with it. It's a luxury in a lot of ways. They do certainly watch movies, but with just the internet and games, I've always been really careful. I don't know. Maybe it's overkill. Someone's probably rolling their eyes at me right now. I know. But one of the things that we've started doing is sitting in bed and playing video games. Of course, I have a strict, like, don't spend money on video games rule. I mean, it's just, I feel like I've heard horror stories of people giving their kid an iPad and then they rack up $400 in like Roblox money or whatever. Anyways, I was playing a free Sonic Genesis. It was like a phone version of like the old 90s Sonic with my son. And we, I think, ran out of lives and we had to get more lives back in the game because both of us are atrocious at playing video games. Anyways, and my son said, oh, don't worry, Mom. I know a way we can get more lives. We don't have to spend any money. We just have to watch some ads. And I get what he was saying, but I remember it was right when I just finished rereading this book. And I had this poor kid, he like stumbled into a landmine. I had this long conversation with him about how whenever you watch an ad, you are spending something. You're just not necessarily spending money. Of course, there's the old term, time is money. I think sometimes with little kids, that can feel very meta. And the way I explained it to him is that, you know, in our current system of the world, you know, if you get in trouble, really bad trouble, you hurt someone very, very bad, you know, you have to go to prison to serve time, a debt back to society, and then you might be able to go free again. And so time is, in a way, another form of sort of currency. Obviously, you can spend time in other ways. I guess I don't know why I brought up the darkest thing. Who knows? Now I'm questioning all my parenting abilities. But I brought up to him that, you know, that time is something that you pay with, that it is a meaningful unit of your life, and that it's okay to think that it's an alternative to money, but I didn't want him to say that it was free, that it's just, think of it like you're paying with your attention span. And, you know, I told him, and this is probably the better parenting choice, but I told him that you know, if I give you 20 minutes to go play a video game, you're not spending any money to get another life. But if you have to spend 6 of your allocated 20 minutes on ads, you're giving away some of your game time. Now, obviously, that's your own choice if that's what you choose to spend on, et cetera, et cetera. But I tried to, in as many ways as I could, explain how our time, depending on the scenario and the situation, is something that we culturally understand is a form of payment. And when you're watching an ad, you are paying into what's called the attention economy. Okay, don't worry, I didn't bore him with the attention economy yet. I'll get there eventually. But that's where I bring it back to the book, because in the very beginning of the book, Jenny Odell lays out what the attention economy is. And if you're plugged into the news as of recently, we know that social media platforms and their CEOs have been in center stage in the news, right? They've always been wildly influential, you know, for the last, I don't know, 20 years or so. But more recently, because of how Wild West the internet has been in terms of regulation, at least within the context of the United States, we've allowed these tech, you know, billionaires and millionaires and people who have this enormous amount of power, as, you know, our cultural centers have shifted online, to kind of run rampant and make these really wide spanning choices about our attention and our health and all of these things. Anyways, all that to say, I'm sure you've heard in recent years the discussion that our information is like the new oil. And in fact, a lot of the breakdown with the whole TikTok ban was about data, data storage, who could have data, who is owning data, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not an expert to speak on this. And I say that with respect to, I did do many, many hours of research in this whole thing. And there are narratives that I tend to align more with, but there's so much to know that I also respect that there's a lot of information here. So all that to say, one thing that came out of this conversation was our information is the new oil. You know, wars were fought over oil over, you know, at least the span of my lifetime. And now our, you know, wars, I'm using air quotes here, but a lot of global conflict will happen due to data and data storage. And so what's pertinent about that is the Microsoft CEO, Satya Nadella, basically said that people are saying that data is the new oil, but attention is the new oil. And all that to say, whether you call it data, at what point does data bleed into attention? But where we put our attention and our information is the biggest focal point, I think, globally, certainly the newest and biggest focal point on the global stage, and certainly domestically within the United States. That is to say that distracting you and pulling your attention in 100 different directions is not a byproduct. It's not circumstance. It is, in fact, largely the main focus. Okay, and the last pain point I'll give here about our attention is, you know, I think what's great about the book is, again, it was written in response to the 2016 election cycle and obviously the election results, because one of the things that now and then President Trump openly deployed as a strategy was putting out ever increasing, like, insanity level headlines. Whether or not he acted on them, it was hard to tell, didn't always happen, but it was a very well-known strategy by the communication wing of his presidency that distraction and crazy headlines were a major thing that he used in order to manipulate power, both sort of on a global scale, then of course, obviously very much in a domestic sense. And in addition to that, you know, I often think as an artist, like a big part of my job is staying somewhat keyed into the conversations happening culturally. In fact, one sort of thing that I think about a lot is, you know, over the span of an artist's career, and that could be musical, that could be visual artist, whatever, there seems to be for a lot of artists, and this, obviously there are outliers, but a time when they just kind of have their finger on the pulse. They've honed their craft to a point where they're very good at what they do, and it seems to overlap with them being incredibly plugged into the world. And at some point, you know, they become a little more removed. They have the luxury to live in a beautiful place and not have to stay so plugged into the needs and the conversations and the people. And they make music that tends to be a little bit out of touch. I think this often gets told as like, oh, they've aged out. I think it has less to do with chronological age and skill and more to do with there is, I think, a certain kind of capital that exists when you are very, very, very plugged in. We know this, I think, largely with things like meme culture. You know, I could talk about memes forever. I will spare y'all from that. But I will just say memes have what I think is an enormous power. You know, I think culturally we think of humor as a lower form of art and therefore we give it less credit, but it is absolutely a very powerful form of art. And the thing about memes is that we all culturally have to have our attention in a couple of different spots for a meme to really strike. Memes are humor. Humor is oftentimes taking seemingly disparate ideas, themes, visuals, whatever, pulling them together and then making something funny, right? I mean, it's hard to explain what humor is. But in order for a meme to be big and explode, you have to have the group enjoying the meme have a certain background of shared knowledge. And a lot of times this background of shared knowledge is, I think, increasingly less just our a public education and that we're all watching the same TV shows and more to do with what's happening in sort of the virtual town squares, so to speak. So in addition to wanting to stay plugged into the news, in addition to the fact that as an artist, sometimes staying plugged in is a part of how you do your craft, we have to, in some way, I think largely, and have to is a strong word, but we are largely incentivized to stay plugged in. And not to mention, Jenny O'Dell spends quite a bit of time in the book also talking about the dopamine that happens when you engage with the news, whether you see someone saying something you agree with and they're dunking on something politically, or, you know, with something that you really agree with, or the opposite, you're seeing something terrible that is, you know, devastating to see on the news cycle. There is sort of this emotional hamster wheel effect to constantly being fed this news. I think a lot of this leads us to sort of what feels like a natural conclusion. When we're on this hamster wheel of news and attention and media and staying on top of your fandoms, and it doesn't have to just be politics. I guess for me, a lot of it tends to be politics, art world, you know, my own corners of the internet. But it can be, again, like fandoms, your corner of the internet, things in your industry, whatever, staying really, really caught up. Which is why Jenny O'Dell, I think, starts out the book by underscoring the title, which is do nothing. Don't say something. Don't respond. Be bored. And one of my favorite quotes, she says, is, in a world where value is determined by our productivity, what we're doing, do nothing. And doing nothing can be a radical act. So in addition to disengaging, doing nothing is also perceived as radical. And she really makes a big point to say it's unstructured time. And I will say, as a visual artist, 1,000%. You know, I look back at my own childhood and, you know, it was a seedy, rough childhood marked by, you know, my parents would struggled with drug and alcohol and poverty and a lot of neglect. But I will say one of the shining lights of my childhood is, you know, the line between neglect and lots and lots of really open free time is a, I think, fuzzy and permeable line, which means that I had a lot of time kind of staring into nothing. One could argue that it was a tad understimulating. And I think, you know, a lot of the parenting stuff that I've certainly been fed as a younger millennial is that you constantly need to stimulate your kids, et cetera, et cetera. And I agree. Believe me, I tend to follow my cohort's parenting style. But what I will say is that personally, I have always had a knack for go be bored. You know, I will sometimes tell my kids if I know that they have been fed and that they've been read to and that they, you know, I have a lot of conversations with my kids. I spend a lot of time with my kids doing what looks, I think, on the outside to be nothing. I say to my kids all the time, go be bored. Go be bored outside. Go be bored. Go grab some stuff and go be bored in the backyard. And the thing is, I think that there's something incredibly productive about that. I try as much as I can to schedule that into my own art practice. I have talked about this when it comes to productivity, that I have a plan A, B, and C for my studio time. You know, I always try to have about 4 hours in the morning. That's just studio time. I try not to book meetings. I'm really protective of that time. And my time can feel so precious between being a mom and my job that it can, even still, even though I know the truth of like how life-giving, unstructured, nothing time can be, I still can feel really guilty when I go in my studio and I kind of just putz around. You know, most days I sit and paint. It's precious time. It's really valuable. I'm fully caffeinated. I should just sit and paint. But there are days when I kind of just mill around in my studio. I kind of pick up a little and then, you know, I scroll social media. I watch a video. And then, you know, before I know it, I'm kind of doing something really random. You know, I'm careful with your social media time, I guess, to each their own. But I find that sometimes going down just like a wormhole is actually the most productive thing you can do. Now, it's not always directly tied to, and then I had a breakthrough. Unfortunately, a lot of the stuff that's processed on the more, you know, subconscious part of our brain, there isn't as, you know, quite a linear level of like, I was bored, then I thought this, then I made that. But I think feeding ourselves that unstructured time can be really beneficial. In fact, in Mad Men, there was a time when Don was talking about his creative process, and he's sort of this, like, you know, creative central conflicted character of the show, and he's labeled a creative genius, and he would basically say that naps were his solution. He'd work really hard on something, inevitably not come up with any idea, and then he'd nap and he'd come up with an idea. And it doesn't always directly one-to-one yield output, but I do think that as a creative, having time and space and schedule for nothing, do nothing, is powerful. What that can look like for anyone is going to vary pretty widely, but Jenny O'Dell in this book makes a good case for it in the first chapter. Another part of this book that I thought was really interesting is that Jenny O'Dell took the time to look at, you know, what do these hermit, like a literal physical retreat from the world, like what can that yield? Is it good? Is it bad? What does that yield? Because we've always had sort of the Emersons, the, you know, the movement in the 60s of people dropping out, aka unplugging from hegemonic society and doing their own thing and starting communes. There's always been a subsect of the culture that critiques mainstream culture and rebels by sort of dropping out. And she looks at a couple of these different cases throughout this chapter, and basically, there were some things learned, some satisfaction gained. There was one person who dropped out. It was like a tech Silicon Valley guy and came back to work so fulfilled and invigorated by this, like, you know, monastic retreat situation where he went off and did a silent retreat, and he started selling it as a way to be productive, was to sort of schedule these do nothing retreats, and sort of the nature of productivity at all cost can even sort of cannibalize, in this case, this well-intentioned dropout from society. So she sort of talks about how there are strengths to it, that there is this constant thread in culture to sort of drop out and reject society in this sort of literal sense of doing nothing. But without the right intention, it can very much end up feeding back in on itself. And a quote that sort of sums up this chapter is, "A true escape from the attention economy doesn't mean total isolation, but more a conscious engagement with the world around us," which is kind of leads into the next chapters of, like, can you, quote, drop out without literally packing up and leaving and rejecting society in total? Because basically in the chapter, all of these, like, failed attempts to drop out have one thing in common. I'm going to drop out. I can create my own utopia. Just kidding. I still need society. Never mind. Right. You know, and it's just all that to say, it's harder than you think. And I really like this chapter because I have my own sort of critiques of sort of the, like, homestead movement. And I will say, brief caveat here, I think there is wisdom and value to doing things like growing your own crops and sharing produce with your neighbors. And, you know, there are aspects of my life that can look very crunchy, you know, at times. But I think that if your intention is to sort of, you know, everyone else who participates in modern society is just a follower and they're not critical and I'm doing things better because I'm growing my own produce, read the second chapter of this book. I think it's a great, you know, eye-opener of how the project of society is not necessarily worth abandoning. And it's just, we live in a much more complicated sort of existence with each other. In chapter 3, we talk about the anatomy of a refusal. So if chapter 2 says, okay, just dropping out and pulling an Emerson may not be the solution we think it is. By the way, I think in this book, I can't remember if it's this book or something else, but it talks about how Emerson, his ability to sort of go live in Walden Pond and, you know, write and critique society from his house in the woods was only made possible because his wife came and brought him, like, dinner and breakfast every day. So, I thought that was funny. Anyways, but how do you live in society and yet create space from society? And I thought this was the most interesting because this fascinates me the most. My personal temperament is I don't have an urge to go far, far away from people and never see anyone else again. I think it's a mixture of growing up in very close proximity apartment complex. I grew up in government housing with, like, paper thin walls, and I like the feeling of hearing my neighbors very close to me. I'm a middle kid, so, like, I love when my shoulders touch someone else's shoulders. Like, I just, living around people personally, and I'm not saying it's better or anything, but just I like it. I think I enjoy the sounds of society nearby. Obviously, all things in moderation. But she talks about two characters that I thought were pretty funny. One is Bartleby the Scrivener and the Greek philosopher Diogenes of Sinope. I apologize for my pronunciation, y'all. But Bartleby was a protagonist of Herman Melville's 1853 short story, Bartleby the Scrivener. And he's a copyrightist who works for a lawyer in New York City office. And Bartleby becomes famous for his repeated and passive refusal to comply with tasks assigned to him. He responded with the phrase, "I would prefer not to." So the story goes, like, at first he was fine. He was a great, like, copywriter and he did everything fine. But then he just started, like, anytime someone would ask him to do something, he would say, "I prefer not to." And what was infuriating about this is it wasn't an outright refusal. You know, that sometimes there's this idea that there's a binary, that you either accept and go along with society and you take it, you know, and you just go with the flow, right? Or whatever, you agree, or you just refuse. You say no, you're a stick in the mud and you resist. But I am always a fan, as a creative person, of the third door option, right? I think the magic of creativity is that you're always looking for a third option, so to speak, and to, of course, make everything really simplified. And I love this because the lack of outright refusal from Bartleby meant that he didn't get fired, and he just kept ending up in these situations over and over again. So it was sort of rebellion through rebellion. Like, it wasn't him fighting back, it was just kind of opting out entirely. And his choice of this sort of weird third option ended up unsettling everyone around him, because it wasn't active defiance, but a profound disengagement from expectations. So I think there's something really interesting about, you're still in society. You haven't like dropped out of everyone's mind. You're not gone. You know, it's hard to be impactful when you're invisible, obviously, you know, to some degree. But by still being there and pointing out this weird sort of third option, kind of like semi-refusal, what it ends up doing is, of course, it's like embarrassing for the person. I'm sure it's so awkward to just keep telling your boss, like, I would prefer not to. But it kind of, for me, I thought, put a spotlight on the task being asked of. I feel like when there's, again, that binary of like, you either do it or you don't, the task in question never fully gets that the attention it deserves. And I think that's what people who are rebelling are trying to do, is be like, hey, this is a ridiculous request, whatever it is, right? And so therefore, I'm going to say no. But it really ends up putting all the attention on the rebellion, where sort of this like conscious refusal subversion method that Bartleby uses kind of puts the attention on the request. So I thought that was really interesting. And then over to Diogenes, who's this great Greek philosopher that I actually didn't know about until I read this book. I've heard of Bartleby, but Diogenes was new to me. But he had a very aesthetic lifestyle, often associated with living in a large ceramic jar, or you could say, I think people said he also lived in a barrel in Athens. And he rejected material wealth, societal conventions, and political systems, advocating for simple life in harmony with nature. One thing I thought that was interesting about Diogenes is he was described as Diogenes the cynic. It inspired me to go down an etymological rabbit hole about the word cynic. You know, my own sort of bias and worldview skews very sincere and earnest. And I often have said I really don't like cynicism, but I was charmed by Diogenes, actually. You know, his whole thing was he didn't, again, pull a Walden and go run away and be out of everyone's mind. He chose simplicity right in the middle of town, right? He lived in a barrel instead of a house right in the middle of the city. You know, he drank water out of a cup, and he had a cloak, and that was all he owned. And there was one story about him seeing a kid or a pigeon or a child, that's what it was, a child drinking out of his hands from a water source. And he sort of said that a child has beaten me in my own game of simplicity. So his whole thing was to live very, very simple as a way to sort of point out the culture. I think this is really interesting, because one thing I'm always like, that I use a lot with like my friends and family talking about the world, is we always say, well, it's their water. Okay. And what I mean by that is like, there's this scenario where I think it's like a joke or something, where there's two fish and they're in a fish tank and they're talking to each other. And one fish goes like, wow, the water's, you know, really nice today. And the other fish is like, what water? The idea being that sometimes things are so omnipresent and just like so in front of your face that you almost can't see it. And I think a lot of times, like, my job as an artist is to constantly be looking for, quote, the water. You know, what is the norm? You know, things that feel like they're just the way that you always do things. You know, when you study other cultures or different people, or, you know, study life in general, you sort of start stumbling on things that you would have never thought about as something to consider because it was just so normal in your life. In fact, I was just thinking recently with the TikTok ban and conversations around China and, you know, Sinophobia and things like that. I was really grateful that in college I got to study Eastern studies as a minor, which, to remind you, like, a minor is just enough to put you at the bottom of the Dunning-Kruger curve. So, like, I know nothing. But what I did learn in those classes and taking Mandarin and all those things was it pointed out a lot of my water, quote unquote, as an American. Things that I thought were just like the norm, the standard. Everyone wants XYZ and everyone's running away from XYZ are, not in fact that, you know, like I remember one of the things was being a good business person, I think, is thought of as so industrious, and there's something so that lives up to good puritanical values that I would have thought that in every culture ever, to be a good business person, and good can also mean ethical too, sure, was to be of the highest standard. And I remember learning that as a consequence of Confucianism, their social hierarchy had business people below basically everyone except for maybe like the lowest peasants. I think the analogy was that, you know, the religious leaders were the head and the noble people were the shoulders. And I'm probably butchering this. There was an order and that business people were basically on the bottom. I went and looked up the Confucian order of society because I was pulling from very old information that I had retained from college. But the idea is that the scholars and nobility are the head. Their role is to sort of think and see. The farmers are the heart and soldiers. And it's funny is like in the West, like the peasants were always one of the lowest, if not the lowest, like the people who harvested the land were considered lower. But in Confucian society, they were elevated. Craftspeople and artisans are the hands. And then the merchants and traders are the feet, because they are thought that they are not directly contributing to society, and therefore they sort of depend on the production of others. Very, very, very interesting. So, and I remember that that was, you know, there was no propaganda in that. No one was trying to get me to think any certain way. It was just simply by pointing out something that felt like water, that was just a natural order of things, was in fact a Western construct. It opened my brain. So by being a cynic, you know, there's cynic and I think the colloquial term of like, you're just being a naysayer, you're just trying to bring everyone down, which, you know, I'm again earnest and critical of, but there's cynicism in, I would call it like the art or the craft of constantly pointing out water and constantly sort of, in Diogenes' case, an ever-growing, an almost cartoonish commitment to simplicity as a way to sort of point out lifestyle of, in this case, the ancient Greeks. Chapter 4, I found to be, I think, the most directly applicable for artists, and that is the exercise of deep attention and deep observation. And she talks a lot about bird watching and how attention is literally something you can manipulate. So I know this as someone who teaches painting and specifically representational painting. You can train the way you see. And I know this with color specifically, that people who study color can start to literally see more color, and that a lot of that has to do with linguistic relativism. I have a whole course called Color Theory that deep dives into it. So if you're interested, definitely check that out. But the idea being, the reason why, for example, that we see so many shades of sort of yellow and orange is because linguistically, yellow and orange are very small colors and next door neighbor perceptively. But green, on the other hand, is a really big color. In fact, a lot of cultures have a word for green and blue sort of blending together, and it's gru, because those are, there's, you know, a lot more colors that we see that are within that color. All that to say, the more language you have to describe color, the more you actually begin to see color. There is a study about the Himbi tribe and how their language has a bunch of different words for green, and therefore they can see very slight color variations between greens. But because they have no word for blue, they have a hard time seeing the difference between blue and green. I will link to the study of the Himbi tribe. Definitely worth checking out. But all that to say is, I think that's really powerful. You can cultivate and change your own attention span. Art, for example, thrives on keen observation. I'm very passionate that the thing that makes someone an artist, a true artist, if you will, and I try not to use words like that because I think we're all artists, but it has less to do with your craft, I think. I think the craft comes second and has everything to do with the way you see the world and your ability to gauge in observations. And in this chapter, the practical takeaways are slow down, observe your environment, take notes, familiarize yourself. One thing I do and have done with my son for the last year is we have this Merlin bird watching app, and we will sit in our backyard, and we have a huge pecan tree in our backyard, and we'll listen to birds. We will. And we have gotten better. Now when I go on a walk, I don't just hear random birds. I hear cardinals. I hear blue jays, although blue jays are very distinctive. They're like aggressive. Anyways, I can hear what a robin sounds like. I know what a white-winged dove versus a mourning dove sounds like. You know the calls. And eventually, that familiarity, it not only helps strengthen your ability to be an artist, but I also like agree with her sentiment that it does cultivate an overall sense of well-being. To me, emotionally, it feels like the opposite of the feeling you get when you scroll Twitter or Threads or whatever, and you have that pit in your stomach dread of like everything's getting worse. It's a very grounding sensation. And I think everyone could use it. But I think if you're an artist, you have to weave that into your daily experience. In chapter 5, Odell basically connects this idea to her broader themes of resisting and specifically the isolating forces of modern life by consciously choosing to see and value others in shared public spaces like a grocery store. We challenge the individualistic mindset perpetuated by the attention economy. Basically, the attention economy pulls into focus that you are being directly spoken to, whether it's through algorithms or, you know, if you ever get those creepy Facebook ads for very specific t-shirts that says, I'm a mom of a, you know, Rottweiler and a football playing 9-year-old boy. And it just can get very weird and specific. And I think it's a good call to sort of stay connected to the rest of the world. And there was a quote from the David Foster Wallace commencement speech, This Is Water. And he basically says, the really important kind of freedom involves attention and awareness and discipline and being able to truly care about other people and sacrifice for them over and over in myriad petty little unsexy ways every day. I love this. I could make a whole podcast about it, but absolutely. The final chapter, chapter 6, talks about restoring the grounds for thoughts. Odell concludes by advocating for the restoration of mental and physical spaces that allow for contemplation, creativity, and with genuine connection. Basically, in this chapter, she reinforces the idea that artists need mental and physical spaces free from distraction to cultivate their craft effectively, to be better artists. The way I always think of this is you have to be intentional. Like, one of my big life philosophies is we give too much credit to the part of ourselves that can white knuckle through things, that can just like have the willpower to resist, you know, looking at our phone or doing whatever insert activity here. And I think we give too much credit to that, but it really needs to be used as like an emergency, like break glass if you need to white knuckle your way through a situation. And when we force ourselves to constantly white knuckle to, let's say it's avoid our phone, right? We're just kind of setting yourself up for failure because you really have to have a lot of the things going, you know, perfectly in order to be able to successfully sort of willpower your way through something. And I think it's a lot kinder to come at it with, you know, why don't we just set ourselves up with success? And I know I talk about this a lot, but it does remind me a lot of parenting where my parenting philosophy created by like Janet Lansbury and Magda Gerber, the like respectful parenting, really argues for, okay, let's say for example, there's this idea of like you create a yes space for your young children. We're talking under 2 years old. And it's a space in your, let's say your living room. You know, for me, it was a tiny little apartment with my first son where I set this up, where there's baby gates and everything within, in this case, it was our main room. Our kitchen was blocked off, our bedroom was blocked off, our bathroom was blocked off, but everything in this main area was safe for my kid. You know, there was nothing in there that was choking size. There were nothing plugged in that didn't have like a something around it that was baby proofed. It was extremely baby proofed. And in this area, you know, my kid could do whatever they want. So instead of having my normal living room, like, you know, the way grownups have it set up with trinkets and fire hazards and not baby proofed, right? Instead of having that and then just, you know, saying no, every time you picked up something small or something dangerous or went near a sharp corner. Instead of always having to be on, you sort of just create a yes space and then you can cultivate play in there, but you can also veg out in there. You can also exist in a place where you aren't having to be completely on all the time. And that was really helpful in my parenting. I have since leveled that up to any point that is age appropriate with my kids. You know, for example, like my son does not have access to an iPad or a phone or anything like that, right? He's at an age where he's interested. We're not going to tempt him. I'm not going to say the internet is bad. It can ruin your brain if you stumble onto the wrong websites and talk to the wrong people. So as a 9-year-old, don't do it, right? Of course, he agrees that he doesn't want to have all that scary stuff happen to him potentially. But to allow his little, you know, jello-like baby prefrontal cortex to try to take on that burden would be cruel and unfair of me to expect that of him. And so out of an act of love and compassion, I meet him where he's at by having these raw, rigid structures around him. We read books together constantly. My husband reads books to him. I read books to him. We play with him. We sometimes go on the internet together and go down a Wikipedia wormhole. But that's how he does it, with another parent with another prefrontal cortex right next to him. And that is age appropriate. And in that same way, I think that chapter 6 basically argues, the way I interpret it, for doing the same thing for ourselves. You know, for me, I don't have a lot of social media on my phone. I have YouTube, and that's kind of it. I have audiobooks, and then I have a work iPad, and I put all of my news and social media on there. Not because I don't think I have the willpower, but like, why test myself, right? It gives me the mental space to be bored. If I have my phone with all my social media, I just toggle between the, you know, I just have no willpower. If I do, it lasts like 2 days. So that plus, and of course, this can be a luxury. I have 2 devices. That's a huge luxury. But as much of that decision-making you can compassionately make, bans on screen time. I know people who, after 5 p.m., their phone turns over to black and white, and there's less dopamine when you're looking on your phone when it's set to black and white. So it's a way to help them have those sort of guardrails on, you know. And then the physical space sense, having a studio space, going on walks, going to parks, going to a coffee shop where you know everyone, but really intentionally curating where you physically are and what you pay attention to. You know, the last thing, if you're still listening, this is a long episode, but I wanted to catch everyone up who didn't want to read the book. This book was so great. I'm so grateful that it was recommended to me by Megan a couple of years ago, and I'm so grateful for the chance to reread it again, especially given the context of the most recent election. I know for me, I have intentionally avoided certain news outlets, and I think if I hadn't read this book, I would be doing that with the guilt. And I think instead, what I'm replacing that news consumption with is I'm going to continue to dive deeper with like nonfiction books, with following certain Substacks and people who write, you know, a monthly article, kind of deep diving into this stuff. And instead of letting headlines and clickbait and outrage direct how I consume news during this administration and during this modern day with everything going on, is I'm going to devote longer attention to these things. And hopefully that, paired with the attention I give to things around class and, you know, red state American culture from the perspective of someone who is very progressive, that I'm hoping that marrying those resources and perspectives together will allow me to have the chance to do or say something hopefully impactful. I mean, as much as little old me can, you know, during this time period. So I'm grateful for it. I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. If you haven't read the book, please read it. I could only hit on the key points. You know, there was so much in there I cut left on the scrap room floor. But I can't recommend it enough. Definitely check it out. It is on Audible and Libby, I know. So if you want to put it in your queue and listen to it later, unfortunately, I think it'll ring true for many, many, many years. So thank you so much for listening to this week's episode. I'll talk to you guys next week. And I will say one last pitch. If you're listening to this point in the episode, I have one spot left open in an alumni retreat that I am hosting in upstate New York this June. It's not just a retreat. It's a retreat / mentorship / artist residency. What is an artist residency? Basically, it's a program designed to help you up level in your career. And yes, much like this episode, it gives you the space and the support to have that deep focus on your craft. We have 12 of the spots filled. We have one more spot open, and the program starts in April. We will start by writing our artist statement together, doing a virtual campfire as we meet each other. And then we're going to do 1 week, June 1st, those 7 days, we're going to be in upstate New York working on painting, style development, and how to take your painting practice to a professional level. After that, for the following 3 months, so June, July, and through August. We will be meeting every other week virtually through our Kajabi community to encourage each other and motivate each other and hold each other accountable with our work. And then in November, we will do a virtual gallery where we will share the work that we made over a very productive 2025. If this sounds interesting to you, we have one spot left. Feel free to email me and I can give you more information. Maybe we can hop on a call. I would love to see if you are a good fit for this program. It's my only retreat and mentorship that I will be offering in 2025. So if you want me to help you take your art to the next level, then here's your opportunity. Thank you again, and I'll talk to you guys next week. Thank you so much for listening and thank you for being here. I wanted to also encourage you guys to leave a review. The feedback is incredibly helpful. And if you leave a review, I will read your handle or your name on the following week's episode. Again, thank you so much. Take care, y'all, and happy creating.